Two shilas for this week. Okay, here are two shilas this week. First one was as follows. It was not a shila that I got, but I'm involved in this amazing program called Smichat Chaver, and one of the Rebbeim had the following shila that he was asked this week, and then someone in my shir in North Woodmere just added to the shila a little bit. So the shila, the Maisa Shahaya, was as follows. There's a group of fellows who are, I think, post YU. They've already graduated. They're, I assume, working for a living, and they live in Washington Heights still, and they were getting together for a Shabbos meal. So they got together for a Friday night meal. A bunch of the chevra got together. There's one member of this chevra that is no longer Torah observant, unfortunately. He learned in the best yeshivas and did very nicely in yeshiva. Something happened. I don't know the details. He's no longer Torah observant, but he's still friendly with all of his friends. So he was also joining in the Shabbos meal, and he brought challah to the Shabbos meal. As they're about to start the meal, one of the guys noticed that the challah was in a plastic bag, and inside the plastic bag there was a receipt, and he noticed the timestamp on the receipt was marked 26 minutes after Shkia on Friday night, meaning that this guy bought the challah after Shabbos had already begun, 26 minutes after Shkia. So now they want to know, are they allowed to use that challah for Shabbos? Are they allowed to eat that challah at the Shabbos meal? Then when I mentioned this shaila in my Smichas Chaver group, someone raised their hand and said, can they use it for Lecha Mishnah? Let's say they don't want to use it, they don't want to eat it. Can they just use it as a second challah for Lecha Mishnah? So both of these are reasonable shailas to ask. So that is shaila number one. Shaila number two, I got the following text earlier this week, or maybe it was last week. It says as follows. My niece has what appears to be a Lyme-like infection that has become very serious. So he explained to me later that she had some sort of, it wasn't a Lyme disease, it wasn't like a tick that gave Lyme disease, but some sort of infection that's affecting her body in a very serious way. A Rebbetzin recommended that she do the pigeon-to-belly-button treatment that is more commonly done for hepatitis. Anyone familiar with the pigeon to belly button? Okay, I'm looking at a lot of quizzical looks. Good, okay. In general, when you need medical advice, you should go to your Rebbetzin. No, you don't. You'd rather you go to a doctor. I mean, if you want to go to, I was thinking, which Rebbetzin would I go to for medical advice? Rebbetzin Rosner. Rebbetzin Rosner happens to be a doctor. My chavrusa's wife is a doctor. So I'm going to Rebbetzin Rosner. I wouldn't go to other Rebbetzins for medical advice. Anyway, scientifically, this makes no sense to me, the fellow writes. However, I'm open to there being things that I do not know. Another factor is the power of a placebo effect, meaning sometimes just people believing that something is going to work is helpful, even if there's nothing to this procedure. Another factor is this may be tsar balechayim, meaning in fact on the other side, cruelty to animals. We have to explain what this is in order to understand why it's tsar balechayim. My sister asked that I help with this procedure. I want to be able to be there for my sister. However, I don't know whether this is halachically the right way to go. The procedure, just to explain it, there's a video of it online. If you Google it, you can find the video. If someone has like terrible jaundice, so their skin is all yellow and they sit there with their shirt up, so their belly's exposed, and they have like a box of pigeons, and someone takes the pigeon, pulls out some feathers from the pigeon's bottom, and places the pigeon's bottom directly over the person's belly button. And all of the illness, supposedly, goes into the pigeon until the pigeon dies. And then you keep doing it until the pigeon stops dying. So you're supposed to buy like 15 or 20 pigeons, and that's how many will ultimately, you know, depending how sick you are, that's how many will get sacrificed, and then you'll have a refuah shleima. So there are videos of this happening. So why is it tsar balei chayim? Well, first of all, you're plucking the feathers out of the pigeons. Second of all, you're sitting there holding them and likely squeezing them to death because there's a reason why they're dying, and it's not because of the guy's belly button, right? So probably it's because you're suffocating them, whoever the practitioner of this this treatment is. So that's the that's shaila. Is he allowed to participate in that? So we have the Lecha Mishnah with the challah that was born on Shabbos, and we have the pigeon therapy.
The first one.
All those who prefer the first one, maybe. Wow. All those who prefer the second one. Oh my gosh, we have a tie. Do we have a tiebreaker?
No.
You said the first one, didn't you? Yeah. Ooh. We have a... The people who came in late can't vote. I don't know what to do now. I'll tell you what. Well, the first one we'll make a 10-minute halachas here next week. We'll do the second one now. Okay, so that way we'll cover everything. So first of all, like, what is this? Where does this come from? Is there a Jewish source to this idea of this pigeon therapy? So there is a sefer called Ta'amei HaMinhagim. That was, and I got this, much of the Metzius information, all of it, from a, I just Googled it to see, and there's a blog that's written by a very intellectual, seemingly very intelligent person, called Talmudology.com. Okay, Talmudology.com. So he points out, and he has a photocopy, he has a cutout of the page from the Sefer Ta'amei HaMinhagim, which was published in 1896, has a section in the back called Inyanei Skulos, and it writes over there, Skula Liarkon Shekorin Galzacht, Gelzacht, a skula for jaundice, is Yikach Yona, Zachar Lezachar, you take a dove, that is a zachar lezachar, a male bird for a male patient, unikevo, or a female bird for a female patient, v'yoshivena al taburo, and you put it on the patient's belly, v'tishav hayona kol hayarkus ad gemira, and the yona will draw out all of the jaundice until it's all done, v'yona tamus, and then the yona will die. And then he writes one more word, baduk, meaning this has been tried and tested. It works. And he writes in parentheses, Sefer Segulas Yisrael. He got this from Sefer Segulas Yisrael. Now, we do find in the Talmud that there is some connection to yellowness and birds. The Gemara in Chulin Daf Chaf Beis, the Gemara talks about the proper age at which a bird can be brought as a karban, and there's a difference between Torim and Bnei Yona. So the Gemara over there says, Yachlu, you call a Torim Chol Bnei Yona Ksherim. You might think that all Torim and all Bnei Yona are kasher. Tamlomar min ha Torim velo kol ha Torim. Min Bnei Yona velo kol Bnei Yona. Prat, l'tchilas hatsiuv. As opposed, tells you that at a certain stage, it's too old for one and too young for the other. That as the bird develops, there's a tzihuv. Me'imasai torim ksherim, mishiyaz hivu. The torim are kosher when they begin to turn golden. Me'imasai b'nei yona psuli. B'nei yona have to be young. That's a b'nei yona. B'nei yona have to be very young. When did they become pasul? Mishayativu. So there is this yellowness associated with birds. That has nothing to do with refuah. This has to do with when it's kosher for a car, when it's pasul for a carbon, when it's too old for a ben yona, too young for a tor. That's when it has this this yellowness. As you might suspect, this does not really come from a Jewish source. Right, so the question always becomes, when you're dealing with these kinds of things, what kind of source is it? And usually the suspicion is that what kind of source is it usually? Avodah Zarah, right? Typically it would come from Avodah Zarah. However, in this Talmudology, he writes that in 1801, Francis Barrett, a professor of chemistry, natural and occult philosophy, published a book, which I can't even pronounce the name of it, and the illustrious professor had come across the pigeon cures jaundice myth in a slightly different form. It was the duck cures colic myth. It's expedient for us to know, he helpfully informs us on page 37, that there are some things which retain virtue only while they are living, others even after death. So in the colic, if a live duck is applied to the belly, it takes away pain, and the duck died. So this does come from a secular source in a slightly different variation, not that hard to, but it doesn't seem to be a Avodah Zarah source, it seems to be just like Stam, an old wives tale. Jewish people still do it adayom. Again, Google it, you'll come across all Jewish sites and a few Arab sites. But Jewish people still do this ad hayom hazeh. On the Or Sameach website, someone asked about it and he said, I don't know of any real evidence, but there's strong hearsay evidence that it works. On the Ynet website in Hebrew, Ani makir rofei mechubad, I know rofei mechubad that does this. Again, all the yeshiva world news, all the news that's fit to print, the yeshiva world news has it reports that a close relative of mine did this procedure and his first father, and it worked. So there are people that are swearing up and down that it works. So the question is, does it? work? Like, why do people think it works? So, again, all this information is still from, it's still from Talmudology.com. We'll get off of that in a moment. But he says that there are several causes of jaundice, the most common of which is hepatitis. Hepatitis itself has many different causes. Viral hepatitis is most often caused by hepatitis A. That's the one you see when people in close contact don't wash their hands enough. It's a self-limiting disease lasting a few days or so. Oh, okay. Now we understand why it works. Because guess what works just as well as putting a bird on the belly? Not putting the bird on the belly, right? Meaning it's something that will just go away after a few days. So people have this terrible jaundice. They don't know what to do. They put the bird on the belly and all of a sudden it disappears. Now, it would truly be miraculous if it worked for hepatitis B, C, or D, which are far more serious, can lead to liver failure, chronic jaundice. So that would be much more of a problem. He said, as the author of this blog, right, you could clap your hands 3 times and the hepatitis would also go away. The other causes of hepatitis are chronic and sometimes fatal. In these cases, no amount of chicanery would be associated with the cure because there wouldn't be one. So no pigeons needed, and they don't add anything. Okay, good. So is there an ism? Is there anything? Meaning, what about the placebo effect? Meaning, this innocent woman was told by a rebbetzin, who presumably was also innocent. I spoke to the guy afterwards, and he told me that there's a very respected mayo that he knows that says that I've done this for people, and it's worked, and I'm willing to do it for you. All you need to do is, wherever you buy 15 pigeons, I don't know where you would go, you know, go and buy 50, I guess Amazon, right? You can get anything on Amazon. So go buy 15, probably not live animals, probably you can't do that, but go buy 15 pigeons and I'll take care of it for you. So what's the issue over here? So in general, Moreno Rav Shechter often points out that the Jewish religion is the only religion on earth that is not at all superstitious. And yet, the Jewish people are often the most superstitious people on earth. And it could be that it's because we have a Yetzer Hara for it, right? Meaning we have an Issus, so we have a Yetzer Hara for a superstition. When the Torah was given, we were the most advanced people in the world. No one else knew about any science. There was just a lot of superstition. And the Torah says, Lo sinashu, lo sa'aneinu. You're not allowed to believe in superstition and silliness. So what are these Isurim? So Nichush is actually no gain of this week's parsha, right? The Gemara says, Kol Nichush she'eino, like Eliezer Eved Avram, is not considered a Nichush, because Eliezer Eved Avram does this what seems like Nichush, right? He says, he makes a whole trick that how I'm going to know which girl is. What does Nichush mean? It means that you take something that's totally unrelated to what your decision is about and use that as a simon that it must be that I'm supposed to do this. Right? A person decides that if it rains today, that's a simon that I'm supposed to go here or go there or something like that. Even though it has nothing to do, b'derech hateva, it makes no sense. There is an exception to this. The Gemara says that they would say to a yunuka, they would say to a child, psokli psukeich. They would pull over a kid and say, tell me a pasuk, what did you learn? Gemara Megillah says, by Haman, right? Tell me a pasuk, what did you learn? And the kid would say a pasuk, and based on the pasuk that the kid learned, they would make a decision of what to do. This is related to the concept of Goral Hagra, which is a thing that is not, an absurdity. It was done by Gedolim V'Tovim. I'm told Rav Ben Chaim still does it. Our very own Rav Ben Chaim does Goral Hagras. I don't know. It's not so much the style in our yeshiva anymore, but I think we assume that we're not really fully capable of doing it. But they say that's how Rav Aaron Cutler decided to come to America. He did a Goral Hagra. Varon Cutler wasn't a Chassidish Rebbe. He was very Chashev Lipshitz Talmud Chacham, Gaon Olam, and he did the Goral Hagra. He opened up the Chumash and it said some pasuk about Aaron should go greet Moshe, his brother, in the Midbar. And at that time, America was called a Midbar because everyone assumed there was no Torah in America. And Moshe, his brother, Moshe Feinstein, is here already. So he went to go to Moshe in the Midbar. So, okay, whatever it is. The Rishonim understand that, yeah, because that's because it's Torah Shebichsav. And Torah Shebichsav is an exception. It doesn't work on anything else. Rav Shechter likes to tell the story of, there's certain Hasidim that will use a book of the Rebbe's letters. and they'll open up to the right. Meaning that I even heard someone once talking in an interview. They said, "How did you know what to do?" He said, "I sent a shayla to the Rebbe, and the Rebbe answered me." Now the Rebbe that he's referring to, not going to name any names, but the Rebbe that he was referring to happens to have been dead since 1994. So he said, what do you mean you got a tshuva from the Rebbe? Well, I opened up the letters and it told me, you know, whatever. So I got a tshuva from the Rebbe. That's what I'm supposed to do. So Shachter pointed that would be a violation of Michush, and he said that once he was in Tannersville and there was someone there that didn't know what to do about whether they should send their child to this camp or not send them to camp, you know, have them come to Tannersville with them, and they weren't sure what to do, and they couldn't find the Rebbe's letters, so they instead opened up a cookbook. They did it with a cookbook. And in the cookbook, it turned out that it had a recipe that their son always loves to eat when he's in Tannersville. So they knew that he's supposed to come to Tannersville. So that's an Issa D'oraisa called Michush. On Rosh Hashanah, the Gemara talks about eating various simanim. And the Sivus explains that the Ramban on Chumash said that a Navi has to act something out as a poel dimyon, which is a guarantee that the nevuah will happen. And it could be that, and Siva says, the same is true for tefillah, that when we associate a tefillah with a poel dimyon, when we make it, you know, we have like a prop for our tefillah, so that makes our tefillah more, makes our tefillah stronger, gives us a little more focus on the tefillah, and that's what simanim of Rosh Hashanah are, that we're not only saying the words, the hiratzon, the ikr is the hiratzon, but we're actually giving like a prop to the tefillah. Then there's Nisav Lo Sa'aneinu, which means that you shouldn't think that there are lucky times. We have a tradition that Adar is Bari Mazle, in the first 9 days of Av are Reya Mazle, perhaps first 15 days, perhaps all of Av, Machlokas in the Achronim, but that Rosh Hashanah points out, is also often misunderstood. That's in relation to a Jew and a non-Jew having some sort of confrontation. A lot of times people say, can I get surgery? It's the 9 days. So Rosh Hashanah thought that there's no problem getting surgery in the 9 days. He said that that you're not working against the doctor. If you are, then you need a new doctor anyway. Meaning he's working with you. It's not like a court case is what the Gemara talks about, that you're going up against somebody else. Mukhei Yosef quotes that you should schedule a wedding at the beginning of the month when the moon is getting bigger, as a simin bracha. But Rosh Hashanah often points out that as well. The Mukhei Yosef in Sanhedrin says that it's mutter as a simin tov, like a kala wears a white gown. Does the person believe that the kala is going to be more pure because she wears a white gown? No, but it just seems appropriate that she should wear a symbol of purity. So getting married under at the beginning of the month when the moon is getting bigger is a nice simin. Do you think you're going to have a happier marriage because you're getting married? Of course not. We don't believe such things. In the Meiselman biography, they printed the invitation, Rebbetzin Meiselman's biography, they printed the invitation of Rav Moshe and Rebbetzin Soloveitchik, and they got married at the end of the month. But they did a few things wrong. They got married at the end of the month. They also printed the mother's name on the invitation. So Rav Chaim didn't learn these halachas, he didn't know. So we should, if only we could educate Rav Chaim Soloveitchik and tell him, you know, these important things. But, okay, so we're not supposed to be superstitious. What about alternative medicine? I mean, this isn't superstition, this is medicine. It's a different kind of thing. It's not based on time, it's not based on random things. We think that this is a therapy that's going to work. I happen to have a book, I brought it with me, because I thought it would help in preparing the shiur, called Sefer Shulchan Halevi on Alternative Medicine. That's Rav Belsky, Zichron Levracha. Rav Belsky was, as I'm sure most of you know, was Rav Shivan Tarav Das, and the posek together with Rav Shachter for the OU. He was a go-no-love. He was an incredible, incredible genius. And one of the things about Rav Belsky was that he knew everything, meaning not just Kala Torah Kula, but like all sciences and like things you would never expect a rabbi, a carpentry, how to sew, anything and everything. He just knew. They said like when he passed away, Rabbi Gnack said that he doesn't know how they're going to measure shishim in a tanker truck without Rabbi Belsky looking at the truck and figuring out based on the circumference and the whatever. You know, like it's just unbelievable. So Rabbi Belsky, it's not, he didn't write this book. He spoke about alternative medicine a few times, and one of his sons put together this book. Most of the book is picking on specific practices that are common in alternative medicine and showing A, how it's based in Avodah Zarah, and B, how it's a total joke, how it doesn't really do anything. So that's what most of the book is about. So he doesn't really, in a clear, organized way, go through exactly what the Yisurim are, because it's really self-explanatory. Most of the things that are based in Avodah Zarah are obviously going to be a problem, and much of alternative medicine has its roots in Avodah Zarah. He goes through many, many examples. He does not mention the pigeon thing. But in addition to that, it's a violation of Tam Tiyem Hashem El Kecha, and forgetting that Hine Loyanu V'Loyishan Shomer Yisrael, the Kodesh Baruch Hu protects us, and people don't want to focus on the Ribbono Shel Olam. They don't want to focus on Tefillin. Instead, they focus on things that are, you know, Mimerchak Tavi Lachma. They're bringing from things that are very, very foreign to us. And he points out, Gemara Chulin Daf Mem Dalit, Harchek Min Akiur U'min Adomalo, that a person is supposed to stay far, far away from things that don't smell good, meaning that don't seem like they belong in our religion. The Rambam in Mor Nevuchim, Chel Gimel Perek Lamed Zayin, writes that wrote Simbaze, Shekol Mashi Yigzuruhu Ha'iyun Hativi Humutar V'zulaso Asim, that anything that naturally makes sense, that naturally can be explained, that's mutar. Anything not is asir. Famously, the Rashba in the Tshuva disagrees with the Rambam. The Rashba in the Tshuva, in Chelek Aleph, in Taf Yud Gimel, says, "Ube'emes yirin, shadavar mukhra mimikomo, sheheim hitiru l'rafua, afilu mashalo yitzerua iunatavish al chacham melu." Rashba says, just see if it works. And if it works, so it's baduk, it's menusa, so it's good enough. You don't need to be able to explain why it works. You don't need to have some sort of natural explanation for it. And Beis Yosef in Yardes, in Kufayin Ches, Tasna's like the Rashba. He says like the Rashba. So it's a little difficult then. How could we assume that it's necessarily problematic? So first of all, they point out in this book that it could be that it's only referring to accepted practices that have been done by God-fearing Jews, and also it has to be something that has no Avodah Zarah component. Meaning it can't be something that, it has to be something that at least people, who are not total quacks acknowledge seems to work. But we don't have to be able to explain how this chemical interacts with your body or whatever. We don't have to be able to explain all of that. But at the very least, it has to be something that clinical studies have been done and shown to work. Not something that, anecdotal evidence of one case, seemed that it worked. You know, you have to have a mass amount. Rosh Hashanah said in Chabura last night, I walked in at the very end of the Kol Chabura, and he was talking about how Metzitza B'peh, how the Mavshik said that 500 babies, they saw that without Metzitza, nothing happened to them. Oh, but maybe if it was a million babies, then something would happen. With 2 million, then something would happen. And he was saying that sounds a little bit ridiculous. I mean, 500, and if it was one in a million, then that's also not a sakana, right? But at least you have to have some sort of study to be able to look at. 500 is a study, it's something. But to just have anecdotal evidence, oh, my brother told me that he saw once that it worked, that's when the medical community rejects it, the Rashba would reject that as well. Actually, it's interesting, right? Belsky, he thinks yoga is asr, which is one interesting idea that comes out. He said yoga is based largely in Avodah Zarah. They clean it up a little bit. So instead of calling it bowing to the sun, they call it sun salutations. You know, these are common phrases in yoga. When they am, they say like a certain like hum in doing yoga. That's clearly based in Avodah Zarah. So when from people do it, they clean it up. Right? Belsky doesn't think it's cleaned up enough. He doesn't think that it's mutter. I spoke to other people, other rabbanim, they thought it is mutter. But anyway, Rabbi Belsky, so what's interesting is he thinks that the right to bendel is mutter. He thinks that you're allowed to wear the red string. He thinks that's not a problem. There's one marker in all of Jewish literature about, prior to the 20th century at least, about red strings, right? And that's the Tosefta Masechta Shabbos. And the Tosefta Masechta Shabbos says that it's mitarkei amoni to wear red strings. So Belsky said, yeah, but Gedolim Tzadikim did it for many, many generations, so mainly it has to be murdered. I mean, anything that's been tried and tested by Gedolim Tzadikim, not tested, but anything that's been done by Gedolim Tzadikim, we can't ask it. Debrezina Rav, the Tshuva says the same thing. He says, I know the Tosefta in Shabbos. I know everything, every ounce of my being tells me it should be Aser, but my grandmother was the most religious lady I knew, and my grandmother did it, and she was a Tzadikas, so mele it's Mutter. That's such an unusual way of paskening a halacha, but that's just stop. That's an aside. So people ask, well, wait a second, what about the fact that it works? We see that it works. So Belsky says, even if, first of all, you need a clinical study to show that it works. He says, even if it did work, most often it's not based on a clinical study. The Medrash Tanchuma in Vayikra says about two Nevi'ei Sheker who lived in the times of Nebuchadnezzar, and they would have this deal between them. When they would see a pregnant woman, so one of them would go over and say, it's going to be a boy. And the other one would go over and say, it's going to be a girl. And they would do that with every single pregnant woman, right? And every time one of them was right. So one of them would say, so every time one of them got a new follower. That he accurately predicted until they each had massive followings because obviously one of them was right each time. So he says the same thing over here. Many practitioners of alternative medicine are beneficiaries of what they call natural remission rate. That there are some people that just get better. You do nothing to them, they also get better. And but then you have a follower if something like that happens. It's really an explicit Gemara in Avodah Zarah, Daf Nun Hey, like that also. Very similar idea that the Gemara says that Libi v'lidcha yoda davod zchav m'les be mashasha. I v'chazin gavri da'azi kimit v'rivas kimit smidi. We see that people come in broken and they come out of the Avodah Zarah all fixed. And the Gemara says, it actually says a little different. The Gemara says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is not going to change his world just to be motzi miliban of the Avodah Zarah. And sometimes naturally people are going to get better. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu is not going to break teva just so that some fool should be able to learn a lesson. And the other argument Rabbi Belsky makes is that the powers of Tumah and Sitra Achra are real and may exist. And maybe there are some of these Avodah Zarah practitioners that can actually do something. Maybe it can work. Still Asir. Even if it works, it's Asir. And you're not allowed to do things that are Asir, even if it works. Gira Grod and Yardes and Kufay and Tess of Katnid Gimel points out that there are still kochos that exist that could be tapped into. But if it's Asir, it's Asir. It doesn't matter that there are kochos that work. And over here, you also have a potential issur. You have Tzar Balei Chaim in addition to the Vizi Surim. You have Tzar Balei Chaim of the animal. You know, the Gemara B'Metzia Daf Lamed Beis tells us Tzar Balei Chaim is Doraisa. Rav Asher Weiss, in one of his more famous pieces in Minchas Asher, says, collects 13 different makoros of how we know Tzar Balei Chaim is Doraisa. I mean, where does it say it in the Torah? So Rishonim Acharonim come up with 13 different possibilities of how we know that Tzar Balei Chaim is Aser. So what does that tell you if there are 13 different possibilities? That none of them are such clear possibilities, meaning that none of them are like, the Torah doesn't say anywhere that you shouldn't be Mitzar Balei Chaim, right? It doesn't say it straight out. So everything is a little bit of a stretch. So Rav Asher Weiss says, but what you see from there is that everything is a little bit. Meaning the Torah is telling you that this is what the Torah feels. That this is what's called, Rechon Wasserman coined the phrase, Ratzon HaTorah. That this is the Ratzon HaTorah. That you get a sense of the Ratzon HaTorah based on all of these things that are so close to telling us that Tzar Balei Chaim are Aser, and that's enough to be a Mechayiv Midoraisa. Now, Tzar Balei Chaim is Mutter if there's human need for it, right? That's assumed by all the poskim, that Ramah and Ebenezer, Simon Hay, says anything that's Tzaruch L'Rafua is no Isser of Tzar Balei Chaim. So he says you're allowed to pull out feathers from a bird, and you don't have to worry about Tzar Balei Chaim if it's going to help in some way. He says, Achzarius, you should be careful about, like, physically, actually, with your own hands. Ramesh says you shouldn't kill a bug with your hand. You have to kill a bug with a shoe, because it's achzarius to kill a bug with your own hand, that a person shouldn't train himself in such midos. How much of a human benefit does it have to be? Shlitz Yaakov in Chel Gimel, Simenayin Aleph, when he discusses medical experimentation, says he could be matir tsar gadol for revach kol dehu. for even just a little bit of benefit. And the Yehuda, in the famous Shuvah about hunting, says sport is also a human benefit, so it's not far by lechayim to go hunting. The Yehuda is against hunting. In the end, he says, don't do it, because who hunts? Nimrod, Esav, these are the people that we want to imitate? Of course not. But he says, technically, it's mutter. So, but over here, not only is not a human need, it's leading someone astray. It's leading someone to do something that's entirely halachically inappropriate. A person has to realize that our religion is a very deep and meaningful religion. The Rambam, the Sakdamat HaChelek, writes, V'zu akas aniyei hadas, the people who are so unsophisticated, yesh letztayer aleihem l'suchlusam, we should be pained by their foolishness. V'yishei mechabdu menasen hachacham k'fidaitam, v'yimashpilem osam betachlus hashiflus, v'yinem v'yinem zeh. It's interesting, when he's talking about people learning Agadat Gemara, and they say that they think they're respecting the Ma'amari Chazal by understanding everything on the surface level. He says they don't realize what a bizayon that is to Chazal. V'chai Hashem Yisparach ki akas hazeh ma'avdim hadras ha-Torah ma'afilim zohara. They're destroying the whole gleam of Torah, the whole beauty of Torah, by taking everything on such a simplistic level. A person has to realize that there is a sophistication in Judaism. We're supposed to be sophisticated people. We're supposed to be people who are evidence-based in terms of, you know, obviously we believe in Hashem, we believe in Tefillah, we believe in things that we can't see, but things that come through the Torah HaKadosha, not things that come through other channels. I have a friend who told me that he's very close with Rav Shlomo Fisher. And he said that he asked his, Rav Shlomo Fisher always talks about his brother, Dayan Fisher, and he always calls him Achia Gadol, and he says he's a much bigger tzaddik than me, much bigger Talmud Chacham than me, everything, you know, he's always talking about him. He said that my friend told me he brought up a skula that he heard in Dayan Fisher's name once, and Rav Shlomo started laughing, and he said, another skula? Achia Gadol, Hagaon, Hatzadik, Abraham Chashif. And he said that he was just joking around. Obviously, he didn't really think that his brother is a machashev, but he was trying to play the, you know, downplay all these schoolers. And he was trying to say the ikur is always tefillah, the ikur is always mitzvahs and meisim tovim. And I therefore told this guy that he should try to explain to his sister that it's unwise to invest emotional energy and precious time that should be spent taking care of her daughter, that should be spent, putting together tehillim groups, putting together people doing mitzvahs together, learning together, and chasing false hope. But you won't see the result immediately from the tried and true methods of Chal Yisrael throughout the generations, because we're not promised results immediately, but ultimately that's what the Ribbono Shel Olam expects of us. Okay, everyone should have a wonderful Shabbos.